Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
So just now I was, we were across the street with Jeff Whitaker talking about like different kinds of, you know, performance production and stuff. Like how for you, and I haven't seen you in a while, how for you has been the last couple of months as far as like putting up shows and producing, like, because New Orleans has a very specific flavor to it as far as like how you produce and how shows go. So what have been your recent projects? What have you been working on?
So my newest project is a storytelling show.
Fine.
Called Unreliable. I was a big fan of Shipwrecked when it was here, and I tried to steal the Shipwrecked brand to no avail. So I just, along with Maggie Ritchie, recreated Unreliable, which is going into its sixth month, this month, November, which is wonderful. So that's been the real project. I, you know, of all of the things that I do, I don't do programming. And so I rarely, I mean, I produce school night every week, but that feels very much like an extension of the conservatory because it's just the recital shows.
Right.
Yeah.
And occasionally a mashup here or there and we don't have a recital. But that doesn't feel like producing a show. I guess technically it is. So Unreliable feels like producing a show. It's been great. It's been awesome.
Yeah. What sort of things have you noticed in your in the stories that you're getting? Is there what's the theme? It's called Unreliable. What's the theme?
Yeah. So the theme changes every month. So the show in a general sense is a curated monthly true story show. So true to life stories, about 5 minutes long. It's curated. So we, you know, ask people to, we invite people to participate, or they you know, email us and let us know they're interested, and then we help them along with their story. So it's a little bit different than The Moth, it's a little bit different than Bring Your Own, which are the other two storytelling shows in the city, and it's different than Queer Mountain, which is the other storytelling show at the theater. And then we choose a different theme each month, and we just let people interpret that theme however they see fit. So we've gotten really funny stories. You know, we did Just Tough Enough a couple months ago was our theme, and we got a story of like a woman who played semi-pro all-women football at the age of 38. And then we got a story of a Korean War veteran who was there for the Bikini Atoll nuclear testing and was sitting on a ship a couple of hundred yards away from the explosion of nuclear weapons. So it runs the gamut between like funny and not at all funny, which is what we wanted.
So it's not all performers that you're getting. You're getting people from all over the city, all sorts of different walks of life.
Yeah, we sort of intentionally do that. We try. So Maggie Ritchie has moved off the show, and Karen Chapman has moved on as a co-producer. And Karen's a writer and a professor at UNO, a writing professor. And so we're getting a lot of writers now from her world. But we are very intentionally trying to only have no more than two people from the T&M community on each show, and then trying to grab people from all over.
How are you putting the word out to like pull these people in?
Yeah, so at the core of it, it's just reaching out to people. I've been here forever.
Gotcha.
I have my hands in five or six different groups of people. Right? So I'm just trying to reach out to people. And then we're doing kind of the general promotion of, you know, social media promotion, trying to get people involved. And we've had a handful of people submit to be a storyteller, which is what we're hoping to grow, to have a longer and longer backlog of people who would like to do it that we can send the list out to.
Definitely.
So for now, it's been us reaching out to personal relations and then getting maybe a half dozen or so submissions over the course of the last few months.
Man, bless you for knowing people not in the theater.
Yeah.
I don't know that I even... Yeah.
Where,
like,
do you find the time?
Yeah, it's like, do you speak to people? Like, how do you do it? Well, it occurred to me the other day that my, like, point of view in the world is so, like, insular. And I was like, somebody was talking about some... You know, people were talking about, oh, my office, now that this stuff is coming out about, you know, women's rights, people are... You know, the office has kind of gotten a little bit better and I don't have to deal with blah, blah, blah. And I was like... What is that? I don't even understand. It's been so long since I've even had like an office job. Yeah. That I was just like, oh, what's life like? I just hang out with smiley improvisers. I don't...
Yeah, it's such a weird microcosm being in this world. I mean, I've been here forever, and I've only been in improv for the last 4 years, so...
Oh, right, so the city is a wider world for you.
I have 34 years of stuff in the city, of knowing people, and the music world, and old radical kids, and tattoo people, and et cetera, et cetera. Rugby people, and high school people, and God knows who else, so...
Okay, so yeah, it's not like you're just going out and hanging out with normies. Like, everybody's got their own, just schlubby office people. Yeah, yeah, at least you're, like, you have a good well of it, like, actually interesting people to
Sorry, join. Office people, we love you. Thank you for listening to the podcast.
Nobody
ever listens to this. Get out while you can.
Yeah. Become interesting. Maybe we'll connect.
You're so cool. Oh my god.
No, it's like one of those things where the most interesting thing anybody, like, in my regular life does is, like, go to SoulCycle, which I do find interesting, but in a different way than they do. Like, I'm, like, terrified that that's something that everybody's super into. Wherever.
Someday offline, I'm going to ask you what that is, because right now I feel like that could take the whole rest of the 30 minutes.
SoulCycle?
No, I don't need to know. I like to imagine what I think it is. Right, I don't want a bike. I just imagine that, like, it's aura. So I'm fine.
Yeah.
Just refreshing your soul.
An out-of-body spinning class.
That's what I love it. What made you go to storytelling as far as, like, this isn't the first show that you've ever produced. So what was the reason why you, like, leaned towards storytelling?
I think Shipwreck turned me on to storytelling in general. It was a show here for a few years that James Hamilton and Sophie Johnson did. It was incredible. It was such a touching show. And that was maybe my first experience really seeing storytelling. And so I think that just stuck with me. And it stuck with me long enough that when the opportunity came, I had been thinking about it for a long time, and then Maggie Ritchie finally, like, grabbed me. We were chatting about producing a show together. She mentioned that, and that was the real catalyst. I was like, cool, this is the time to do it. And we did it. Storytelling, I mean, you know, it's cliche to say, it's the way that we've always communicated. It's the way that we've, you know, it's lore, it's myth, it's everything that we understand about humanity from times before there were recorded history. It's, you know, storytelling is the core of our civilized, you know, way of life.
Yeah.
So.
Is that, like, as far as, like, the true story aspect, are you interested as far as, like, what the swath of human experience is? Because, like, when I do sketch or improv, I try to think about what human experience is and then bring it into characters that don't exist. But,
right,
you know, talking to real people changes it up.
Yeah, I love seeing what people come up with. I try to encourage people to interpret the themes in whatever way they can. You know, last month in October, we did Spirit, which, you know, was supposed to sit in the kind of TNM RIP Halloween-y world because our show's at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted people very badly to interpret that however they wanted to. And Tammy Nelson was on the show, and she interpreted it as school spirit and then told a story about me in high school, which is great. That's what I want. I want people's personalities and the different ways that people view the world to come out in a singular show. Each show so far has had very much its own vibe. Like, it exists in this weird little bubble. The lighting's weird. It's just a single spotlight. We have a musical guest that plays in between sets. And so it really creates this, like, cool bubble of energy for each show.
So you find a different musician every month?
Yeah.
That's, okay, so it's, like, different... Do you try to match, like, the genre of music to the theme, or
and just let it be magic when it's going to be magic? That's there awesome. Have been a number of times that the musician doesn't know the stories beforehand. There have been a number of times. Maybe the musicians are, like, working on the fly, but there have been a number of times where they'll start playing a song. And it's like, this is very related to what we just heard.
Awesome.
Or even better and more magical, they play a song and then the story after is like, wait a minute. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's like a group mind situation. All of a sudden, the musician feels connected to the storytellers and helps develop the whole thing. I like that music idea. That's really awesome.
It's such a cool idea. Again, I stole everything from Shipwrecked. Like 100% unashamedly. The show was great and I wanted it, so I did it. With the help, of course, of other people. But yeah, one of the things that they did was they had a musical guest each time that plays in between each song, in between each storyteller as transitions. And it's worked out really well. We've had, every single time, we've had just acoustic guitar and vocalist, just a single person, not a band. I'm trying to remember if Tyler brought a keyboard or not. I think he ended up with a guitar. Either way, it's like single person, the spotlight shifts, so there's like a spotlight on the musician and they play a song and then it shifts to the storyteller and they do their story. It's great. It's awesome.
No, that's, and it seems like the ingredients for that show are something that New Orleans has in spades. You know, it's just, you're never going to run out of musicians here and you're never going to run out of interesting people.
Yeah.
And that's a really good thing to keep in mind building a show is like, what do I have plenty of in this environment, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, it's like, why not utilize the world outside of this building to help build a show, you know? It's really, really smart.
Well, and I think when thinking about producing a show, I think we get starry-eyed so easily, especially in this community where it's like, I want to do everything because there's so many people doing everything, that we get starry-eyed and think we could do anything, when I think it helps to look at, like, what are you passionate about? Or what do you know a little bit more about? Or what is it about your personality specifically that draws you to this type of show?
Yeah.
You know? And I think that helps make it work.
Yeah, yeah. Like a self-evaluation of kind of like, what can I put into this that would actually set it apart from anything else?
Right.
Do you think your effort in that way is built on the fact that you've been sort of mentoring the community for the past couple of years? Like, because I feel like, you know, in my mode, when I'm teaching more actively, I'm dealing with everyone, whether it's the person at, you know, who's the cashier at HEB or the, like, you know, guy at Jiffy Lube. I deal with them all like I'm their teacher. I'm all like, right. How's it going? What's going on? Right. How are you? How's your day? You're doing great. Look at that. My car is so running great right now. You know, so I wonder if the experience you've had, you know, doing, you know, mentoring the TNM students has helped develop that.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know. I haven't thought of it that way. Hmm. I think for Unreliable, my organizational skills are what I use most. But I'm not... I don't know. Hmm. I haven't thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at it from the outside, yeah. So of course I have a different point of view to the whole thing. How has been... being a leader of the community, people must come to you. You have to give people advice all the time. How's that feel?
It's great. It's easy because I can kind of honestly say the things that I would want to say, which is rad. I find myself qualifying the statement when I say it, but I don't think I need to because I think it's pretty true. And I know people have had other experiences, but this community feels like a meritocracy. Or as close to a meritocracy as we're going to get in modern society. And so I feel comfortable telling people, if you hustle and you're around, you're going to get what you want. And that was my experience very clearly. And I know that other people have had more difficult experiences than I've had. And some people have had the opposite experience than I have. Mm-hmm. But I still feel like I'm being pretty honest when I say that this community is a meritocracy. Or is it at the very least intended to be a meritocracy and sometimes fails in that effort. And so when people ask me for advice, the advice is always keep doing what you're doing, show up and be nice. And that's it. If you do that in this community, you're pretty much going to get what you want or get the shot at least.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people in just the performance industry, you know, theater and film and all that, a lot of times that's all you need. I mean, especially the be nice part. Like, yeah, sure, there's some people that are dicks and you're like, how is that person a jerk and yet that somehow they've made it through? And it's like, well, some other way they found it. But like, whenever I talk to people who are like trying to move from stage to film, I'll say, when you go on the audition, they're not only trying to figure out if you're right for the part, they're trying to decide if they want to hang out with you for a year.
Yeah.
Like, because they're going to hang out, you're going to sit next to them. I mean, 90% of film acting is sitting and not acting.
Right.
So it's like, can you spend time with these people and they're not going to be like worse person?
Yeah.
The be nice part, I think, is a big, deal.
I mean, like, it's only after you've been really successful that you get to like stop being nice if you want to. I think once you're a commodity, I feel like that's when you can turn the asshole on if you want to.
Yeah.
Or the level of talent has to be so great that it's worth it.
Yes.
Right? So like the meaner you are, the better you have to be.
Yeah.
If you're a normal talent performer or you're growing in your talent, you better be nice.
Yeah.
To get and keep getting gigs.
Yeah. If you're a friggin' genius and every time you speak, people are all like, is Shakespeare here? Because I'm totally filled with goosebumps.
Right.
Then you're like, oh, but he's a jerk.
Then you can be method on set and send people rats as the Joker character and people are going to be mad about it. And they're like, you're Jared Leto. It's okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I can't wait to be Jared Leto.
Jared Leto. I mean, I love him, but he's definitely one of those actors who, like, he'll be in everything and then everyone will just rip him to shreds.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all like, that asshole. You're like, what? He's great. Like, he's not horrible. I don't know.
I'm gonna go to bat for Jared Leto. Yeah. I don't know him at all personally, but I'll go to bat for Jared Leto. I think that dude's probably an okay human being.
Yeah.
I
mean,
of course, I watched My So-Called Life when I was a kid, so it's like just right there in the nostalgia heart.
Sure.
Yeah, so maybe I'm blinding myself, but
no, but I mean, there's a bunch of other things that he's been in where it's like he's a bit part here or there, and you're like, it's great. He literally didn't have to do that much, but he filled in this spot that he needed to, and it was great.
Yeah.
You know,
and he will like commit to something that like really he shouldn't. Kind of like, I think he put on a lot of weight to play the guy that shot John Lennon.
Nobody cared
about that movie. Like, it ended up just happening and going away really quickly. And it's like, now look at you. Now you're like 85 pounds soaking wet as the Joker. And it's like, we're still mad at that. I don't know. Like, it's like, but he keeps doing it. And it's like, you gotta say something for indomitable will.
Have you seen the pictures of Christian Bale playing Dick Cheney?
No.
Yeah, he's gained, you know, 60, 70 pounds.
Well, that's...
Christian Bale, I love him so much. And he's, so I bet, a huge dick.
Exactly.
And he's the worst.
Yeah, there's like sort of documented evidence.
Yeah,
which I've tried to defend, by the way. I have to admit that I've tried to be like, okay, there's no reason to yell at somebody who's working on a set. Let's start with that.
Yeah.
But man, when you're putting that much effort into a thing, and that dude's putting all of his effort into every scene that he does, right? You're going to snap at some point, right? And if you're trying to do it and you're on take 7, and you've got to do it for take 8 because some kid was talking, it's like, he's going to snap. It's like, that's not an excuse.
No.
Like, don't yell at the poor kid, you know, who's just a grip or whatever he's doing. But like, but the pressure has got to be great.
What if we find out that he didn't sexually harass anyone, then I'd be like, we're fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's going to be like, but he never tried to have sex with me. Huh? Okay.
He just yelled at me.
No, he definitely, and like he drew back like he was gonna, you know, but it's fine. It's fine. That's what happens after, you know, you lose 150 pounds to play like the machinist or whatever, and this one kid trips over something.
Right? Man, think of those trainers who, like, when he comes back and he's all like, what's up, Christian? Okay. Start with some cardio. All right.
Yeah.
Like those trainers who work with them, the people who fluctuate so intensely. And I wonder about like doctors. Like when they talk to them, they're like, you really shouldn't gain 60 pounds.
Oh.
You know they could give you a fat suit, right? Like you literally don't have to do this, but they're so method that they like have to understand what that means.
Yeah, exactly. And I guarantee you doctors are telling them. I mean, his kidneys are ruined from that stuff. I mean, fighters have this problem.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of MMA and I think about MMA a lot. And fighters have this problem from cutting weight. Can't handle that, and his body is not going to be healthy because of it. I mean, he went from the machinist to Batman pretty quickly.
Very quickly, yeah.
And I mean, he must have gained 50 pounds of muscle to do that. It's like, that is not, I mean, obviously going down to the weight that he went to the machinist is not healthy, right?
Right.
But even going from where he is up to to where he's playing Chaney and then back down to his normal weight is going to be unhealthy.
And like you also have to like think about like the added pressure of probably constantly being recorded on some level. You know, it's like when you're on set, there's audio equipment everywhere. The idea that like at any point that you might lose your emotional stability for a second, that it's going to go on TMZ or some shit, like that would stress me out. Like the idea that I have to like sound like a good person all the time.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's like because everybody should be afforded a hissy fit, you know?
Yeah. And,
yeah, but I mean, again, with reference to like this, the stuff that's going on right now where it's like, people are being horrible to each other in a sexual nature and a like in using their power to make people do things they don't want to do. Like, I feel like in that new world of film and stuff, like, because things will change over the next like 5-10 years where the industry won't allow for sexual abuse, but I betcha it's going to be totally fine to be just a diva.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's like, hey, you know what? Like, that's all right. And Christian Bale's one of those people, like we were saying, like his talent is so amazing. He so completely becomes that person that you're like, let him yell at me.
Yeah.
I will accept it. Like I would legitimately become his personal assistant,
right,
knowing he would scream in my face, right, and I'd be like, mm-hmm, yeah, okay. Yeah. You're right. This latte is disgusting.
That's Batman spit on my face. That's great. You know, like,
you're welcome, sir.
Yeah, I what were you saying before? I had a thought. Where did we get?
What were we talking about? What were we talking about being recorded a lot? Or
yes, it was. And all I was going to say was like, it's the quantum theory of observation, right? Things change as you observe them,
absolutely.
And that absolutely happens in celebrity, mm-hmm, right? I mean, you talk to, you know, if you hear celebrities speak honestly about their experience, more often than not, that experience exists, or some element of that experience is like, you're being observed all the time. It feels like you're being watched.
Right.
Right. I mean, my sister gets or used to get like Us Weekly magazines, and they have spreads in them that say they're just like us. And it's pictures of celebrities like going to the grocery store and like feeding their kids. And it's like, Ben Affleck is just like us. He shops at Trader Joe's. It's like as if people are astounded that celebrities are human beings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has got to warp your sense of reality. How could it not warp your sense of reality if people are treating you like that? It's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Nicolas Cage being this other sort of... Not even... Because he might be mean, but like that's that falls so far down on the list,
yeah,
of
right,
things Nicolas Cage is.
Yeah.
You know, like he is... He is a madman, and but the thing is I'm kind of like that with how you are with Christian Bale, where it's like, I would love to just be like his therapist, or like, you know, like somebody who's in charge of his emotional well-being, just to watch it fly out the window,
yeah,
every day, you know, like, because I think he started off like that. I don't think Nicolas Cage built up to being this insane.
No.
Like,
Nicolas Cage was
like
born
that
into a film
world
family.
Yeah.
So, like, he didn't, like, he isn't, like, a guy from Omaha who, like, worked,
yeah,
his way up. He was, like, born, and then they were like, wouldn't it be cool if he were in this movie? Like,
right,
almost like my baby, who I put in all the things. Like, already put him in a movie. Like, it's like,
yep,
yeah, he's just going to get used to that. And
yeah,
later, when he's an accountant, he'll be like, yeah, I did some movies as a baby. It was embarrassing, you know?
No, I was going to say, like, it was, I mean, he was like a month out, and I was just like, hey, is it cool if I write a sketch where he's a wrestler? You know? Like, I was just like, when is it okay for us to start writing your baby into stuff?
Yeah.
You know? Like,
he's
when
gonna,
is it
he's
not child
grow person into the baby size wrestling mask.
Yeah.
In order for that to be okay.
I wanted to actually get a luchador mask and,
yeah,
put it on the baby, and
yeah,
I was like, I really had to understand that that's probably not okay yet. You know, like, just,
well,
like,
he just wouldn't put anything
face
on his head.
Yeah,
yeah,
he's like, covering
his
face, we gotta wait a little more before I can start covering his face. I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
He's, like, just super new to breathing.
Yeah, no, he's gotta get a little better being alive just on his own.
Yeah, just
yeah,
a couple
just
times
with everything perfect and him being able to breathe well.
We take advantage of all these things, like our bodies working and us knowing how to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny how... but I mean, with reference to Nicolas Cage, like, I feel like he already knew what the world was like, because I'm sure, I mean, all of that family is in the movies, whether they're directors or producers or actors or whatever. So it seems just like he swung in and was in everything. Also, yeah. I bet he's not a jerk because he's in so many movies. He wouldn't be in so much stuff, I think. I mean, admittedly, his name has some cachet, so that helps. Right. But I think that, like, he has to be a little okay or else, like, you know.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with him evading taxes and owing the IRS a ton of money.
Does he? That's hilarious.
Yeah. So I think he's in a lot of movies because he's paying everything. All his money is going to the IRS and he's trying to pay down his debt.
That makes me feel a lot better about the fact that very recently my husband and I decided to watch every movie we could find with Nicolas Cage.
It's great.
We've watched even the random, we're like, what is this? And I was like, just turn it on. Yeah. Who cares? Let's watch it. And we're like, this is horrible. I was like, to the end, man, to the end.
That's great. That's a really fun project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's like for a minute there in the 90s, he was like my favorite action star. And it's like Con Air, Face Off, The Rock.
Yep.
Those are three of my favorite movies. Like for real, in a real way. And it was like he went from finishing Con Air to the next day doing Face Off. And it's like, holy shit, man. Like, it takes a lunatic to be able to pull that kind of, like, effort out. And also to just make two of my favorite movies back to back. You know, like, literally, those two movies are perfect in my eyes. Mainly because John Travolta comes and adds his own level of craziness.
So insane.
And then John Malkovich, you know, like, not even knowing what the hell this movie's about. Like, I remember seeing something where he went to the screening and he was, like, excited to see what this movie was. Because they were constantly writing and editing Con Air, like, and rewriting while they were shooting. So, like, John Malkovich got out of that set, and he was just like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
What did I just do?
Well, a lot of times in movies, they, like, don't tell you what the rest of the movie's about. They give you your page.
Yeah,
you read your thing, and then you're like, okay, great. Yeah. And they're like, so you're an angry guy, and you're going to yell at this guy for 3 minutes, and then you're going to leave. Thanks, have a great day.
Well, Malkovich's part was relatively small in Con Air, too, so it's reasonable to think that, like, he probably got 7 pages of the 90-page script. 70-page script. It's Con Air.
Yeah.
But he didn't get very much of it, which has got to be a cool experience, though, going in and being like, cool, I'm going to watch a movie that I'm in. I have no idea what's up with it.
Yeah, 100%. Fun. Like,
it's like improv.
We just crashed a plane into the Vegas Strip.
Yeah.
But I was in jail in Alaska. Like, what the hell?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is like improv, right?
Shit.
It's like, cool, I know I'm a psychopath. I know nothing else. See what happens.
Oh,
well, it's like, you find out Nicolas Cage is on the project, and you're just like, oh, okay, so this is not going to make any sense from start to finish.
Right.
Like, no matter what, this is going to be the most interesting thing that's happened to me all year. You know?
Oh, man. Well, I guess to that question, what's the most interesting thing that's happened to you all year?
All year.
That's a, thank you for that phrase, because I was like, that's a nice wrapper-upper.
Oh, man. Okay.
It
you tell
like
any
story,
story
the storytelling
kind
of, show that you've done seems like you probably have to leaf through a lot of examples there.
Yeah, I know. What is the most interesting thing that I've done this year?
Yeah.
Has this year been a normal year?
I mean,
I went to Egypt in February. That's the most interesting thing I did. That was
what?
Yeah, I went to Egypt on a Magical Egypt John Anthony West tour in February for 2 weeks. That was life changing, incredible.
Wow, who's John Anthony West?
So John Anthony West is an Egyptologist that I encourage everybody to look into. And the tour was run by Dr. Robert Schock, who is his colleague and also an incredible. He's a geologist. Yeah, he's a geologist. And they're incredible. And the tour was, so John Anthony West and Robert Schock were the ones who helped prove that the Sphinx is significantly older than we thought it was, because there's water weathering on the Sphinx and there wasn't water in the Nile Valley for thousands of years. And so their tours take you through Egypt and kind of explain what they believe to be a different history than we've come to understand. So Egyptologists, you know, think that these structures are, you know, were built in ancient Egypt times, and we're beginning to realize that they were probably built significantly earlier than that in some form or fashion.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's That is super wild. Egypt. It's such a politically volatile place. How did you like, I mean, I'm always worried being an American to like go to any place where they're all like, you guys are the worst. So I wonder with all the tumultuousness, did you encounter any weird politics or anything, or did you just go straight out to the Sphinx and that area and not the cities?
So the tour, I tried to go out in the city as much as I could. The tour is very well constructed. Mohammed Nazmi, I can't remember the name of his tour company, but he's the guy who runs it in Egypt, is very well connected. And they have done this tour for like 20 years. They did it. There was a tour happening during the revolution. And I got to see one of our tour guides. I got to see his video of him being in Tahrir Square during the revolution with his kids. He's like, I took my kids and brought them out. And then he told me this incredible story about like taking the tour people and trying to get them to the airport where they could be secure, and like having to go back and forth from Giza to the Cairo airport, which is like a 20-minute drive without traffic or a revolution. And they were like trying to get people back and forth. All that to say, they're very careful. We had like guards with us when we went through some of the smaller, you know, we were driving, because we take a bus a little bit from Cairo into some of the smaller cities. And so we'd have like military guides. We'd have a guy on the bus with us with an automatic weapon, and then have like police in front of us. So they like, because tourism is so important, and because since the revolution, tourism has died off a lot, they were very careful with tourists and very thankful. I mean, it was strange. I know we're over, but it was strange driving through these small towns and seeing people who were not receiving any income from the tourism industry. I mean, these are people who are just farmers living, you know, in the countryside, waving to the tour bus excitedly because they recognize, assumably, that tourism is an important industry to Egypt. And when tourists come, money comes. And like tourists coming back after the revolution, it took a while for there to be, they'd already, you know, it's still, you know, they're not as packed as they used to be.
People are, was it mostly men, or was there women and children as well on the tour?
On the tour, there were men and women. There was one teenager, no young children. Right. But it was fine. I mean, Egypt is a relatively progressive country.
Sure. Yeah. They have revolutions. That's pretty progressive.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So there's not really any, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't run it anymore, which I don't know if the women would have had to shawl up if the Muslim Brotherhood was still running the country. But there was none of that. Everybody was perfectly accepting of like us being our American and Canadian and European, you know, lifestyle and culture, you know.
Right,
so everybody's walking around in shorts and normal clothes and no one cared.
Oh, okay.
And everybody was really excited and just wanted us to buy their little trinkets.
Yeah, because that sounds great. I mean, I'd love to go to Egypt. That sounds like so amazing.
Dude, I mean, John Anthony West is battling cancer right now, which is why Dr. Shock ran this tour. But hopefully the Magical Egypt Tour exists. That's what it's called, in some form or fashion, whether or not John Anthony West is able to lead it again. And I couldn't recommend it enough.
One hopes he's mentored people who will take on the idea and carry it after he passes away.
I don't think that's a question at all. I mean, Sohaila, who was our Egyptian tour guide, is this just like force of nature woman. She's incredible. And she is very much an acolyte of John Anthony West. So if nobody else is going to do it, Sohaila can do it. You know?
Awesome.
It's incredible.
Well, thank you, David, for sitting down with us.
Yeah,
that's fun. Sorry we only had a short time, but you're great. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yep,
and good luck with all the projects you're working on.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, y'all.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
So you do stand-up? Is that your main comedy?
Kind of. I don't know. I mean, I try to like split my time evenly with all the different things I do, but like stand-up is definitely one of the things I've done the longest. Yeah.
What are the other things that you do?
I do improv. I've been doing short form for the longest. I went through TNN's school, so I did long form there. I do sketch. I do a lot of theater as well.
Yeah. Like plays and stuff?
Yeah, plays and stuff, yeah.
Oh, cool. My stuff was like in musicals.
I do mostly musicals and straight plays, actually.
Great! That's amazing.
And my wife got me into it when we first started dating. We were at a bar with a bunch of other theater people that she's friends with, and they were like, yeah, you should audition for Damn Yankees. You'd be great. And she turns to me like, and we need straight guys. They need to look like baseball players. I'm like, okay, that's cool. ever since then, I've just been barely holding myself on stage. Kind of keeping up, but not really standing out, you know.
Well, the musical crowd is like such a high intensity. I mean, to perform not only on stage where you're projecting and you're mm-hmm. doing that sort of like presentational thing, but then musicals are so, I mean, there's suspension of disbelief to every second where you're like, no one would do this.
Yeah,
why are they dancing?
Yeah. And that's always the fun thing is like finding the character. Even if you're just a chorus member, like it's so fun just find these like goofy characters that have zero dialogue, but like what kind of person would see someone singing on the street and just join in harmony and like backup dancing like that? It's the funniest characters you could play in chorus members, I think. Like,
yeah. I like that you put so much effort into like just being like, you're like, I'm a chorus member, but I care about the character that I'm playing.
Yes.
Because I think, I don't know how much film you've done, but very recently I was talking to somebody about how when you're in film, they don't really direct you. Like in plays, there's a person who's like, hey, you do this, don't you should do that. But in film, they're like, great, you got to figure it out. Sweet, we're rolling now.
Yeah.
So like every bit of development that you're doing as a chorus member makes you a better film actor because you're like, he was just standing in the back and he was the most exciting part of that scene.
But you also have to like not, obviously you can't draw too much attention from it, but you gotta fit, you know.
No, but like committing to developing a world, like have you ever watched a like period piece movie where like you know one guy in the back like just is not committed to the fact that it's the 50s?
Yeah.
Like you're like, that guy keeps doing something and I can just tell he doesn't know what he's
doing.
That's
why he said I have to be in the 50s. Age, not the year.
He's got like gray hair somehow, but he's very young.
Yeah,
he's real curmudgeonly.
He's got a Hawaiian shirt on. He's like, what is going on?
Yeah, absolutely. You're all like, what are you doing? This is shag. We're in, you know, you're supposed to be dressed. This girl is in a, you know, like a.
Are you checking your blood sugar back there? What the hell, man?
I love this. This is now like my. I love this character. This guy who like doesn't understand what movie he's in and keeps going like, "No, I'm doing it. It's great."
Yeah. I killed it.
Guys, you should see this movie I'm in. I am the best background guy.
The poor editor's like, "Son of a bitch."
You're like, "All right, tighten it in. Get that guy out of there." You know. Oh man, yeah. No, that's. Musicals, that's so awesome. I love that. So have you been in New Orleans forever? Like, are you born and raised?
Yeah, I'm born and raised here. The only time I lived outside of the city was after Katrina. I relocated to Missouri pretty randomly. This is where my family relocated to because we didn't have anywhere else to go. We had a family friend up there. And it's a little ass backwards up there and right in the middle of the state, you know. Mm. You're not close enough to the cities to have like any tolerance or diversity.
I was gonna say, what the hell's going on in Missouri right now?
Like, because that was like, I'm so glad I got out like when I did because like I went to Mizzou and they had all the issues going on there with just like hate crimes and like just awful stuff happening. I don't know if I can curse.
You can.
You can. You can.
Shit. the chancellor and the president and like the head football coach like all resigned, and like the football players were like, we're not going to play unless these people are held accountable. It was crazy, and it's still real bad too. Like just every day you see some crap like that happening. You're like, what the hell's wrong in that state? Because there are good people there, but then there's just like these pockets of like rural Missouri where they have zero exposure to human beings that don't look like themselves or like go to the same churches as them. Like even like I was Catholic when I went up there, and like Catholics were like white Catholics were non-existent. Like the only places I could go with church was like the multi-denominational thing where it was like a circle. It was like church in the round, which was very odd.
Huh.
And as a Catholic, like, you're like, all right, where's the tabernacle? Where do I like genuflect to? And there's no point of reference anywhere. It's either that or the Hispanic church where everything was either in Spanish or Latin. And I was not much to choose here, bro.
I assume like Baptist and Methodist majoritively there, or
some form of Protestants. Though it is nice. That's where my Catholicism died, so that's always a good place.
Oh, okay, that's where you buried it. You buried it in Missouri.
Yeah.
Did they like beat it out of you?
It was a combination of Katrina happening, which was like a big test of faith.
Sure.
And then
that mixed with, like I said, just the isolation of all these people that are like supposed to be good Christians and they're just fucking awful people. And I'm like, hey, this isn't, I'm not feeling it. And then just, I got arrested for DWI. I'm like, no, nah, I'm done.
Yeah.
There's no plan for me. This is all garbage. I'm done.
I'm done feeling guilty when these assholes yeah, exactly. are running around feeling great about
exactly.
themselves.
Yeah.
Oh man, that can be hard as far as like being in a situation where you're like, I'm being the best I can be and yet I have to deal with crap and this jerk has a nice job and a pretty wife and a bunch of money. Yeah. Get out of here with this.
Yeah. I know like the evangelicals that live there always try to talk about like, I forget the term for it, but like Christian prosperity where like, if you give to the church, you'll be prosperous. And like sowing the seeds and all this. And yeah. they're all into that stuff. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you're just wealthy because your parents were wealthy.
Right. Yeah.
Or you made your money off the backs of poor people. Like that's really where your prosperity comes from. Not from being, you know.
See, yeah, it's interesting how people misconstrue those kinds of stuff.
I think it's great that like, you know, Like you had legitimate reasons for kind of losing your faith, where it's like some, like me, I just was like, well, this isn't cool. Like, I'm just,
this
like,
isn't cool.
I was a teenager, I was an angry teenager, and I was just like, I'm done doing that. And that was it, and kind of never looked back. I feel like I, you know, like, I've kind of come back around on spirituality a little bit, but in a very open-ended sort of way.
Yeah.
Like, and that's more just, because my mom's listening. And,
our number one fan.
Yeah, yeah. And the only way I could get her to go to sleep is just be like...
I definitely see the value of, like, spirituality. And, like, my in-laws are part of this, like, very small church. They've always been in small churches. And those, I think, are outstanding. Like, they really help out the communities. They help out each other. There was the church they're going to now, the pastor... gave out $100 to all the parishioners and said, pay it forward, kind of thing. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you never see that with, like, institutionalized religion at all. Like, I think that that's wonderful, and I could get behind that. I don't really agree with the book they're reading from, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
like, those types of things, I absolutely see the value in it, and it's just, you know, tribalism versus, you know, institutionalism.
Well, sometimes I wonder if maybe the way that we live now in larger cities and the fact that we imagine ourselves part of a larger country and then even the internet, so I can talk to somebody here or there, that's too much. That the smaller groups, like you're saying, the small church or the small group of people, you know, like even the theater, you know, you can sow the seeds of prosperity within a group just by being like, I'm going to be nice to you. And then you're happy because someone was nice to you. And then you go be nice to somebody else. Yeah.
But then if you go too far, then all of a sudden you're like Missouri, where you have only tiny little pockets of, you know, mayonnaise people.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a certain, I mean, it's like being in small groups, but then also being like the other groups are valid in their, their situations. Like, I don't get you, but I'm excited you're there.
Yeah. I love inclusivity and injecting diversity, like wherever possible. So that's like the one downside to doing those types of things. If they are not open at all, like if they're very restrictive of their small community, that's when it goes bad. But like they've always seemed very cool. I'm like, you should come. I'm like, I appreciate the offer, but I like sleeping on Sundays. My church is the bed.
I earlier this year I took my girlfriend back to South Carolina, where I'm from, and she's Catholic, she's Mexican, and she was really scared to go to a Baptist church, and I was like, these are well-founded concerns, but it's like one of those things where the church that my mom goes to is actually one of the better examples of a Baptist church that you could find as far as like everybody meaning well and sort of contributing to the community. But we went at 4th of July, so I take her in and the entire inside of the church is just red, white, and blue. Half the hymns we sang were like America the Beautiful, you know, like all this stuff. And we come out and she was trying so hard not to laugh the whole time because they really nailed in that whole like American Baptist kind of vibe, you know? And I was like, she was like, so you guys do that every Sunday? And I was just like, no, you just happen to come on, you know, America Day. So,
where we celebrate American Jesus.
Yeah. And yeah, no, She.
He's white. He speaks English.
Yeah, yeah, it's Captain America, but it's Jesus.
Yeah, blonde haired.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Got a bucket of KFC with him.
Yeah. Yeah, the resurrection was when they put him inside the thing and filled him, and then he became buff. That's how it worked.
And then he got a star-spangled top hat.
He's like, this is my body, and he flexes on it. And they're like, yeah, I want to eat that.
I like the idea that, like, a person would go to the, like, most insane day of a place and then go, this is what it's like every day, right? You're like, no, this was an event.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, good. Well, because it's like being Catholic and going to a Baptist church, it's like nobody's trying that hard, is what it looks like. You know, it's like Catholicism demands like rigors, discipline and call and response things. And
very cultish. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
A lot of standing and sitting and kneeling, and there's an order and stuff.
Absolutely.
How do you think Jesus got so ripped, man? Before doing all the exercise, yeah.
Yeah.
No, to your point about like on an event versus like, you know, what is normal, I feel like everyone thinks that about New Orleans. They come during Mardi Gras, and they're like, that's how it is. So, like, it'll be the middle of, you know, April. And people are just wandering around the French Quarter, and I was like, can you please move? This is a street. I'm trying to drive.
It's
11:30 in the morning. Like, come on, man.
I have to go to my job right now.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
I know. I think that about in Austin with South by Southwest, because like the entire month of March, we were just talking this morning about how everyone from Austin vacates and Airbnbs their own homes. Mm-hmm. So it's like just for that 1 month, it's a totally different place, and then it goes back.
Well, Jazz Fest is kind of the same way around here, near the festival grounds, because they're people that's how they almost supplement their incomes for Jazz Fest. They're like, bye, have fun. They just like their whole house rents for 3 weeks, and that whole area, I avoid that like the plague. Like it's not worth even walking too much, less driving. Like, fuck that.
Yeah. It's like ACL and South By, it's like Austin just turns into like an extension of California. You know, it's like, or like any other place in the world. And it's like all of a sudden, I don't want to be here for a week, you know?
Yeah.
And then everybody thinks, oh, is this what it's like all the time? The other thing too is that in March in Austin, it's the only month where it's the perfect temperature at all the time. Mm-hmm. Every other month, it's either like, are you dying because it's 110? Or it's like, it seems kind of okay. Wait, there's wind out of nowhere. Yeah. Like, so people come in, they're like, this place seems fun. And I was like, can we move South By to July? We would really lose a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird that you don't talk about that, though, because I feel like it's almost like a culture war going on right now, in New Orleans at least, with festival seasons and, you know, short-term rentals and, you know, the influx of using tourism as your main industry versus, like, actually having any other economy. Like, I hope that doesn't happen to Austin, but y'all have had a huge influx of, like, young professionals and the technology sector has been growing there, too.
Oh, yeah, we're much more likely to become San Francisco than we are to become New Orleans.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not as nice in Austin as it is in New Orleans. When you walk around, whenever I walk around here, no matter whether the person is like well-to-do and well-dressed or like homeless on the street, everyone's still like, hi, how you doing? That's great. So it's a very different vibe because it's a bit more, I've lived in Austin for about 7 years and it's become more and more standoffish.
Yeah.
Where instead of, I used to walk around and just go like, hi, hi, hi.
Yeah.
And now people are like, what's wrong with that girl? I still do it, but they think I'm weird. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm just going to put a Keep Austin Weird shirt on and say hello to people as I walk down the street.
I think it's one of those things where that's when you turn into a big city, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Because like San Francisco, the couple times I've been there, it still has that small town vibe to it, kind of like New Orleans does, where people are still kind of friendly or willing to help you out, or like, don't get weirded out when you smile at them. that's always fun. Yeah.
Yeah. My husband's in Pennsylvania for work right now, and when I talk to him on the phone, I go, "Where do they stand on the Sir Matt Ma'am thing? Are they pro or against it?" He's like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "Call somebody Ma'am right now and tell me what their face says."
Yeah.
And they're like, "Oh, she was fine with it." And I was like, "Interesting. Okay."
Because
I'm from Boston, and in Boston, it's an insult.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you call someone Ma'am, they're like, "How dare you?"
Yeah.
And you're like, "Why am I? I'm being polite to you."
Yeah.
But they'll rip it to shreds.
It depends on how you say it, too, because this is...
Sometimes.
Yeah, like, some friends of ours will be like, ma'am, 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 you know, very sassy-like, and that's definitely one way to, like, shut someone
yeah, down. Yeah, it's kind of, it's a little condescending.
Ma'am, you know.
Yeah, but even if, even when you're shutting somebody down with that tone, by using that phrase, in my mind, you're still being respectful of them. They're like, you're like taking the high ground where you're like, ma'am, you need to not be crazy in some way, but I'm still being respectful of you.
Yeah.
And I think that helps. Cause I mean, certainly with, when diffusing trouble or people who are being, you know, who need to be ma'amed, then, you know, they need to know I'm the, I've taken the high ground. I'm the leader in this conversation. Oh man.
An effort is being made to respect you. You know, it's like it, and no, it's coming from South Carolina. It was always yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. No matter. Like I say that like to little children too, you know, and it's like a lot of the times it reads like I'm calling you older or something. Like I'm indicating, like, don't call me ma'am. I'm not a ma'am yet. It's like,
that's what Boston says.
Yeah. It's like I'm calling you grandma or something. And it's like, no, I just have to say ma'am or else my mom is going to feel it somewhere. You know?
But yeah. My mom came and stayed with me for a month after I had my baby and she had to get used to it in Austin because she'd be like, it's super weird when they call me ma'am. I was like, they mean it well. They mean that they care about you and that you're, they want to give you respect. She's like, all right.
They don't actually have like, yes, it's just yes, sir. Or yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So what's the like big project you might be working on right now? What are you, developing?
So yeah, I do a late night sketch show called Big Easy Live. It's kind of like a SNL vibe. We got a show coming up in December. We do that quarterly. So, because our cast is primarily people from the local theater scene, so not the comedy scene, which is actually kind of interesting because you deal with people that are used to being on stage, used to scripted material, they know how to do the right beats and everything like that, but they make very strong, different choices that I don't think the writers necessarily have. Like, for example, I wrote a sketch one time and one guy took it in a completely different route and it's for the best because I'm like, yeah, like that was a weak sketch that I wrote, but you made it like so much better. And I think that helps having people that, you know, have like decades of acting experience getting that. And then we also involve a lot of the local playwrights as well to write sketches too, because, you know, it's just an easy break from, you know, doing 40, 50 pages instead of just knock out five. You know, that's pretty quick and easy to do. And we'll bring in like local talents to be like the guest host and they bring in their own audiences and stuff like that. So that's kind of what's on deck. Yeah.
That's awesome. So do you have like a writing team that's separate from your acting team?
A little bit. Like I said, we almost have like not freelance writers, but like contributing writers. But some of the people in the cast also like to dabble in writing. So, and it's been nice seeing them improve as well, just because for them, it's like, oh, let me give this a shot. And now they're like, I have to write five sketches. I'm like, okay, that's a lot. But all right, yeah, if you want to do that, then have at it,
Is this like a consistent like staff, or do you like shuffle people in and out?
So the core cast is the same. Like we have a repertoire cast. And
gotcha.
In terms of the writers, yeah, it's about like four or five of us that are like the same.
Gotcha.
I try to bring in new people. Just, you know, it's always nice to have different voices.
Yeah, totally.
And give them an opportunity to try some on stage. And then we also do like some film sketches too, so it's always fun to have people that aren't in the show but want to be a part of the show will, you know, have an act in some of these. So
it's great that you're connected to like every different sort of artistic group though, like the fact that you do musicals, so you have that crowd. You could easily write a musical sketch and know that you get people who are like not just singing but like singing on point and like the right notes and in harmony.
And that's I think and not to knock on any of the sketch groups because they're all great, but I think our tone and delivery of the sketches tend to be more polished because again it's theater people. So like when we do tech, they're used to theater tech, which is like a day long process and like blocking and, you know, knowing everything about how the scene is supposed to be set up. Like you said, with a director in film versus a director in theater.
Yeah.
So like I have to sit in as the director a lot of times and like actually, you know, place people where they need to go. But again, everyone's so skilled at what they do in terms of acting that I rarely have to do anything. Like they get the gist of where they need to be and things like that.
But are you the main leader of this show?
I don't be called the leader, but yeah.
I mean versus the director or producer,
the head writer, things like that.
Yeah, but like you book it, you like put it in a place, and call people.
It's
and
my
go,
baby.
No, that's awesome. How is the how have the guest hosts been?
They've been wonderful. Like our first one was definitely the most like SNL like. Sketch, like the opening monologue, had the cast members coming on, like, oh, hey, and like, we've tried to throw in musical elements too, because all of our people have done musical theater and they have that following. And then our guest host for December is Lene LeBlanc, who she used to have a show called Drunk Tunes, which is like a live animated sketch comedy show where we would voice the characters drunk. Like while it's projected behind us, so that was a lot of fun. So I'm really excited for her because she's done theater, but theater's not like her primary platform. And I know that she's skilled enough to do whatever the hell she wants. She's an amazing performer, but I always like having those elements where the host brings, we try to write to their talents, you know, and that's been the big thing. Like she's a wonderful character actor and she makes these amazing characters. So we've been trying to like, all right, what crazy stuff do you want to do, Lene? She's like, I got this. We're like, perfect. Let's put that person in the scene and get through there. Yeah.
That's awesome. How long is the show? Like an hour long?
Yeah, a little over an hour. Yeah. It's at the High Out Lounge.
That was my next question, was where was it
at? Yeah.
So it's not like Proscenium Theater with,
I mean, I would love to have it at a big venue, but I get to do two monthly shows at High Out. So I try to throw in. We do our short form group Brown every month there, and that does well. And then for the other ones, like, well, let's mix it. Let's try a different thing. So we do like a video sketch showcase sometimes, or I do the show Modern Vaudeville, which is like a variety thing. We actually did it as an open mic talent show. So people would come on, do whatever their primary talent is, and then the finalists would draw a random talent to do. So I had like a deck of playing cards that I made that had different talents, like magic or drawing or
juggling or
We did have juggling. We had memory. They had to memorize like all the state capitals and like recite them and stuff. just like random
like
talent.
Memory is like a talent.
Oh man, that's a
I don't have that talent, so it's good that you indicate this.
Rhythmic gymnastics was one of the talents as well. Just like random stuff. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
How long have you been doing Big Easy Live?
This is our fourth show, so we're just finishing up our first year of doing it. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, every crowd, every show, and excited to see where it's going towards, because we just keep getting better hosts each time, and they're all great, but like I think the audiences are really starting to respond to it, and the writing's getting better, so excited for it.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. I like that. That's 4 months is an interesting point where you've like done it and you're like, okay, am I going to keep doing this? Yeah. And then once you make that decision, it could be years.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is wonderful because it's, you can switch around, especially too if you're still doing plays and mm-hmm. you just meet new people and you're like, dude, come do this show with me.
Yeah, that's always the fun thing too with doing those shows, like with Drunk Tunes. We would always get people that weren't in the comedy scene seeing it, and they're actors or something, like, oh my god, I gotta get involved in this. And Lene was like, that's great. We need animators and writers. We don't need actors. Like, we appreciate it. You get to do all the fun stuff, but we need people to do the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And that's I'm kind of the same boat. I'm like, everyone's like, how do I get involved? I'm like, do you write? Can you edit film? Because those are the things that I need to get off of my plate. So if you could do that, that would be.
Sounds like you're good at delegating. I like this. I need to call you to help learn that skill.
Yeah. I'll just delegate it to him to teach.
Very good. And with the jokes.
Yeah.
So what's the most interesting thing you've done in the last year? Like, what's as far as like things that you're working on, other than Big Easy Live, what sort of adventure? It doesn't have to be performance, even.
I've been, like, dabbling in making music, like comedy music. And so it's been fun to like, because I'm not a musician like in the slightest. I'm a software developer. So like learning on like FL Studio how to like make songs, it feels like programming rather than like art, if that makes sense. But yeah, just like doing all these songs in different genres and like just learning music theory and, you know, just being a goofball in a different way, you know. I'm used to singing, you know, songs on stage that other people wrote, so it's kind of fun to do my own songs that I wrote.
Yeah. It must be interesting to, like, use the knowledge that you have of software development to, like, use the programs. It's good that your brain functions that way, because I'm not a computer person. I have a hard time using those programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's... I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. A lot of people always try to ask me about, like, how I do comedy and that stuff, and I'm like, it's different parts of the brain, man. Like, you don't... Mm-hmm. Like, I don't use my analytical side when I'm writing, because I know some people are like, jokes or laughs per minute, and like, how do I get like as many jokes spot? And I don't think of it like that at all. That's a completely different side of my brain, and I don't even know if it's worth trying to tap into, you know?
Yeah.
But I think in terms of like attention to detail and things like that, I think that's more for the production side of performing rather than like the on stage side. You know?
So with the comedy music, is there an end game there? Is it just kind
I have an album planned. I'm gonna record it after Mardi Gras and hopefully get it out, you know, by the summer. That's kind of the goal. But that, again, like I'm not that creative enough to pull out like a full length album. So I'm like just kind of doing a half hour stand up with the songs and like splicing them up a little bit in between. So that kind of helps. I think if anything, it feels more like a one man musical than a comedy album. But yeah, you know, it's still, if it's recorded and it's comedic, I guess it's a comedy album.
Sure,
awesome. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's lots of different musicians that have, you know, sort of a vibe to them.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, so when you do, when you intend to add the music to it, do you do like a bit of stand-up jokes and then you break into song, or is it all song?
Yeah, the idea was just to have like, you know, 5 or 7 minutes of comedy and then kind of segue into a song that's a little bit related. I know a lot of people have different opinions on stand-up when it comes to segues and things like that, and when you build like a half hour, you know, you kind of need that natural narrative to kind of flow through it, for most people at least. And so that's what I was kind of going through. But what I try to do instead is have the songs be the segues, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like I'll be talking about dating and then go into a song that's about a couple and then go into my marriage and then talk about kids. It's like, so it's just, I feel like it's more of a narrative, like a one-man show would be, instead of just like a traditional stand-up act. But yeah.
Yeah. Is there any comedian or performer that you're like emulating, that you like watched and you're like, I want to do what he's doing or she's doing?
I guess Bo Burnham.
Yeah, that was kind of coming to mind. I don't ever want to like get super comparative when people are working on projects, but yeah, that kind of...
Well, I just meant as inspiration. I mean, because you even talking about the narrative part made me think of like Mike Birbiglia. Mm-hmm. When he does a stand-up show, he doesn't sing or whatever, but from the beginning to the end, he's telling one single overarching story and then a bunch of little stories in between.
Yeah, I would say if there's any like artistic inspiration, it would be more towards the musical theater side of things, like where you have a scene of dialogue and then a musical number and then a scene of dialogue, and like the musical numbers either heighten the emotional state of the character or showcase what they're talking about. There's not necessarily plot being driven through the song, but the song is elevating the plot points, if that makes sense.
So yeah, totally.
I think with the stand-up, it's like telling jokes about something, and I'm steering towards what my next bit will be about, and I think the song kind of heightens on that concept. Not necessarily what exactly I'm talking about, but just like the concepts of that, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think that's so great. And you mentioned about how like some people think this and some people think that. I was like, hey man, you're a great creative. Like, why worry about what other people are doing? That's their own journey.
Yeah.
You have so many great influences. I mean, just the musical theater stuff that you're doing and bringing, you know, a different group into like sketch comedy is so fun. Don't worry about what other people are doing. You're doing the cool thing. I like your stuff. Yeah. No, it sounds great. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah.
I look forward to the album.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
I don't know when or what it'll be called, but yeah, it'll happen.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for sitting down with us.
Absolutely.
And we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Enjoy
your stay
in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Always do. Always do. Better or for worse, I always walk away feeling pretty good about it. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love being here.
Yeah. Tired, completely exhausted, half dead, but happy.
It's like a marathon. It's like at the end of it, you're like, I got somewhere.
Yeah. And I learn something every time I come. Yeah. You know, it's like I get a little better at it every time. You know, it's like, all right, today I'm going to put some bread in my body first. You know, like I'm going to cushion the liquor a little. Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Oh, man.
But,
this
was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing everything with us.
Y'all too.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.